Welcome to the Wampa's Lair Podcast. Deep in the bowels of the frozen ice caverns of Hoth, our hosts, Carl LeClair and Jason Hunt, discuss all things Star Wars. So join the conversation and hang out here in the Wampa's Lair.
Ujabba.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of the Wampa's Lair Podcast. This is episode number 218, The Force Awakens, Act 2. I'm, as always, one of your hosts, Jason Hunt, and with me, the Han Solo to my Chewbacca, we have Carl LeClair.
That's classic.
Yes, it is.
Well, they do have a lot to do with each other in the second act of The Force Awakens.
That is very true.
So we've been away from this particular segment for a little while because of all of our Rogue One coverage, which makes sense.
Yes.
We've been away from a lot of our normally scheduled programming, if you will.
Right.
So
your regularly scheduled programming.
So we wanted to get back to these breakdowns of the three individual acts of each film. And we last left off with Act Two of A New Hope. And we're going basically sequentially in each trilogy. So we're going to be doing Act 2 of Force Awakens today. And also, we will be getting back to Tales of the Larians very soon, just in the process of scheduling the next one. So be on guard for that as well.
Woohoo!
But before we hop into the episode at large, we do want to give a particular shout-out to another one of our Patreon supporters. And this one goes out to the official unofficial sponsor of this episode of The Wampa's Lair is Paul Gann, which I know, Jason, you have a particular relationship with this individual.
I do. He's been listening to us for quite some time, but he is also my co-host on my Doctor Who podcast, Talking Time Lords. So if you're a fan of Doctor Who and you want to hear me and Paul talk about Doctor Who, check that out. But yeah, Paul's a great guy, and I found him for the Talking Time Lords by posting on our Facebook page saying, hey, I'm looking to start a Doctor Who podcast. Anybody out here like Doctor Who as well? So Paul's been listening to us for a long time, and glad he's supporting us on Patreon.
Yes, thank you for saving a Wampa pet, Paul, and for supporting the show.
Yes.
So again, you know, it's wonderful to have so many supporters on Patreon. And Paul, thank you for being one of those said supporters. And I think Paul is the only person who listens to the Wampa's Lair besides you who also likes Doctor Who.
You, sir, jest.
I'm sure I am mistaken. I'm sure there's a lot of you who also enjoy Doctor Y. Or, I'm sorry, wrong question, Doctor Who.
You're funny. You're funny.
Sorry, Jason. I always screw up Doctor What. Oh, sorry. Oh. Doctor Who. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't even know.
In case you couldn't tell, Paul is Carl.
Get it right, Jason. God, which co-host are you recording with?
Right. Carl's not a fan of Doctor.
I wouldn't say that I'm not a fan. I just don't know the show. I've never really watched it.
Well, there you go.
My favorite experience of Doctor Who, though, was when we were playing ping pong in Anaheim a few years ago, and you did, I don't know the character's name, but what was it, Jason?
Oh, this is a random line from an old classic episode, and
you failed, Mr. Fibuli. Failed.
You kept saying that to me every time I made a bad shot, which was regularly, so, which was a great time. Funny. That was a good time.
We had a blast.
But, well, luckily, there's another celebration coming up in just about 2 months, which is amazing.
Hallelujah.
And happy to report that Jason and I both were approved yet again for media badges, so which was great because we gambled by not buying passes in
yes.
hopes that we would get media badges again. And the confirmation came in this past week, so we're both very excited to be representatives of the Wampa's Lair and the Star Wars fan community at large at Celebration yes. Orlando coming up in April.
Yes, that will be a blast. So I cannot wait.
Yeah, I can't either. And I think when I bought my plane ticket 2 weeks ago, too, I was like, okay, this is real now. And then the media badge approval was the final, like, oh, good. That plane ticket wasn't in vain.
Right. All right. But, well, let's get back into the episode here. We're not doing our poll because I didn't feel like we had enough responses, and we wanted to let more people respond to our poll before we closed it, which is, what is your favorite piece of music from Rogue One, from the Rogue One soundtrack? So we'll remind you about that at the end of this episode. But Carl,
yeah.
So we didn't have the poll results today. You wanted to bring up another point that you've been thinking about from our discussion last episode, correct?
Yeah. The last episode was one of the most fun episodes we've done in a while. It was a really good time. It was great having Riley on to talk favorite music from Force Awakens and Rogue One. And so it's no surprise if you have listened to that episode, you know Jason and I share our favorite piece from that soundtrack, which is the title track called Rogue One, which goes a little like this. I'm tempted to play the whole piece, but I won't. but Jason and I both picked this as our favorite, mainly because it's just like a great pump-up piece, comes at a great time in the film. But what I wanted to do with this particular track, though, is I feel like we all did a great job of tapping into our inner David Collins, you, me, and Riley last week. And
yes.
I continued, I think, like,
the three of us combined equal like half of David Collins, but yeah. We made a good showing.
Exactly. I mean, like I said in that episode, I've been listening to the Rogue One soundtrack at large a lot, and this particular piece pretty regularly. It's kind of my wake up and get dressed song. But as I was listening to it, what really stood out to me is this piece, I think, is it's very kind of triumphant sounding. And I think that makes sense because, you know, the reason they're known as Rogue One is because they're about to go rogue. This scene is them going rogue. They, in a way, are stealing that shuttle because Jyn and Cassian and the rest of this Rogue One crew, they've made a decision contrary to what the council decides. The council says, we're not going to act on this. And they say, screw that. We need to. So they go rogue. They're going to do what the Alliance Council is afraid to do or unwilling to do at this time. So they kind of call the shots. And the reason I kind of wanted to look at the piece again was a little bit later in the piece. I'm going to go to where it swells here. So right here, they're on the shuttle. And they're pulling away. And the music is very intense, very, very urgent. And here it falls away, but it's still that same Rogue One theme. And what's going on right now is Mon Mothma and Bail Organa are talking about how war is inevitable. And she asks him, I'm going to pause it there. She asks him, you know, about going to get, you know, Ben Kenobi. They don't know that Rogue One has pulled away. They don't know that some of the rebels have gone to act on this. But they recognize that war is inevitable. And what I think is so cool musically, and again, this is where Giacchino is absolutely incredible. And it's so perfectly like John Williams, is he continues that theme after the shuttle has pulled away and we're not even focused on those characters anymore. And I think he continues the theme again. It's a little bit more understated because the effect of what they're going to do is going to have kind of like a ripple effect now through the rest of the Alliance, which I just think is so incredible. So that theme, this Rogue One theme, continues here even as they get ready to kind of like their actions are going to have this ripple effect. So I just think that's really, really incredible that, you know,
even Mon Mothma and Bail Organa are going rogue in their own subtle way.
Exactly. So these actions of the few are about to affect the many. And if you think about it, if it weren't for kind of the brave courage to go against the status quo that Jyn and Cassian have, this wouldn't have happened. You know, they wouldn't have potentially ever gotten the Death Star plan. So I just think it's really cool that Giacchino continues the theme even after they've left to indicate to us, the audience, that what they've just done is going to have a ripple effect. It's going to affect the Alliance at large. And then, like you just said, Jason, now Bail and Mon Mothma decide to go rogue. So I'm just going to continue this here. And then this is where he's talking about Kenobi. So we get the Force theme. You know, mm-hmm. I would trust her with my life. Which is right here. And that's how the piece ends. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring that back in because I wanted an opportunity to talk a little bit more about that particular song. But it's just really good. It's the only time in the movie that the piece is used. And, you know, it's played very triumphantly for the Rogue One crew, but it still continues. The theme continues even after they've left, which to me is a reminder that even though they've left, what they've gone to do is going to have an effect on the rest of the Alliance.
Right. And so. It's... any chance we get to bring that piece of music back in is okay with me.
Such a good song. Such a good song.
It is. It is. So, anyway, I don't think we should take too much more time talking about that because we've got an entire act to get to here for The Force Awakens. So.
Yes, yes. And act twos are always the most exposition-heavy acts of a Star Wars film, typically. So there's always kind of a lot to get through.
Yes.
So we left off in Act 1 with Kylo choking out one of his officers saying, "What girl?
What girl?"
We're going to pick up right after that. And we have this great little exchange between Finn and Rey. And Rey is trying to fix, you know, some sort of leaking pipe that's could potentially, you know, let poison gas into the ship.
Right.
So she's busy trying to fix this. And give Finn instructions. And, you know, she wants Finn to tell her where the Rebel base is, the Resistance base. But, of course, he doesn't know because he's not actually part of the Resistance.
Right.
And, of course, we get...
He has to admit that to BB-8, and BB-8 just like...
yeah.
Roll. No! You lied to me? It's pretty funny. I love it. And he has to convince BB-8 to give up the base, and we get the awesome back and forth of BB-8 swiveling his head back and forth between the two as he's trying to figure out what he has to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we get the thumbs up.
And we get the thumbs up. So again, this was something new, again, seeing this for the first time. I mean, I was cracking up in this scene because this is a different type of humor for Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say each trilogy so far, granted, well, this trilogy is far from complete, but each trilogy has a very different type of humor, you know. The OT, most of the humor really lies in Empire, and it's more of like witty humor, sarcastic humor. The prequels have a little bit more goofy humor. But this also, it's kind of more comedy humor in Force Awakens. And I say that like because it's really funny at first, but I don't laugh anymore at the thumbs up. Like, I don't dislike it or anything, but it's not funny anymore because I know it's coming. It's so funny those first couple times because it's just like, oh my gosh, it's so hilarious.
Right. But I still grin every time I see the thumbs up, though.
Yeah. So, again, a very different type of humor in this type of movie. They get into, you know, kind of this argument, and we understand, though, kind of they both have different goals in mind now that they've left Jakku. Finn's goal is to get away. You know, like, you're a pilot. You could go anywhere. Why go back? And then for Rey, this is the first statement we're going to get of it, and we're going to get it a few more times in Act 2, is Rey wants to go back to Jakku.
Right. She doesn't really say why.
Right. You got a boyfriend, cute boyfriend?
That's none of your business. And then, you know, we immediately have to jump away from that discussion because things start shutting down. The Millennium Falcon is being taken over by another ship, and they're being pulled into a hangar.
Yeah.
Which, of course, Finn immediately assumes is the First Order.
Right. Right. Which is a fair assessment considering they were literally just being pursued by TIE fighters.
Right.
And Finn doesn't get a look at the ship until it's you know, the maw of it is swallowing it up.
Right.
You know, and this is very much, there's quite a few, you know, Campbellian elements in Force Awakens because it's very similar to A New Hope and the start of a hero's journey. This is the first time where our hero is kind of swallowed into the belly of a whale, right?
Right.
That's that shot of Han's freighter swallowing up the Falcon is very much like a bigger fish swallowing a smaller fish.
There's always a bigger fish.
Yeah. So Finn starts freaking out, assuming it's the First Order. And this right. is going to be a consistent theme for Finn, is Finn is terrified of the First Order.
Yeah.
Because he's obviously had a very unique look at the way it works.
Exactly.
So this guy is terrified, and you know, there's not a whole lot they can do, because it appears as if they're both unarmed. Neither one of them have a weapon. No. Rey has her staff, but that's it. Neither of them have a gun. You know, trying to think of anything to do. And, you know, and this shows how, you know, kind of quick with it Finn is Finn immediately says, well, what about the thing you just fixed? Can you unfix it? Because Finn is drawing on his knowledge of stormtroopers, you know, right. And she says, do you think this will work on the stormtroopers? Yeah. Their masks only filter out smoke, not toxins.
Right.
And I always thought the way she kind of looks at him there was
yes.
my indication of like, she's curious how he knows this.
Right. How do you know that?
Right. So, you know, because later on Han's going to keep indicating to Finn, you know, she's going to figure it out if you don't say something.
Right.
But to me, that's like the first inkling that she might be onto something there. Cause the way she just kind of looks at him, like, who knows that, you know, like,
right.
How would you know that?
Exactly. And then of course, you know, they hide down in the smuggling compartment, trying to undo what they've done, to, you know, flood the bay with poisonous gas. And Han and Chewie come on board.
Yeah. I'm going to play this because it's one clip I could listen to over and over again.
Chewie, we're home.
So good.
Yes.
But yeah, this is the first time in the film now where we're going to meet one of our original characters from the Star Wars saga.
Yes.
And, you know, we get that what's now pretty much an infamous line of Chewie, we're home. And by the way, home is a huge concept in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of being home. And, you know,
right.
for Rey, you know, even in this movie, she describes home as Jakku.
Right.
Han and Chewie are declaring the Falcon to be home. You know, in Rogue One, you know, Jin is welcomed home by Cassian. You know, I think in the Star Wars world, home is where you find connection. It's where you find your sense of belonging.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, this is obviously reading into that scene with hindsight, because we know how the movie goes moving forward. But for Han and Chewie, it's very clear, like, what they're up to right now, back into their smuggler ways, they are not at home.
No.
And the Falcon is both a physical home as well as kind of like this more metaphorical home for them.
Right.
It's a place where they've always found, you know, their sense of being at oneness with themselves, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's this great line where, you know, Han is declaring that they're finally home. He immediately just starts, you know, pressing buttons and everything seems to be responding to him.
Right.
And it does. It is where they belong. And that it great, you know, underscore of the rebel theme right there. You know, like, yes, they're back.
They're back. We finally get to see Han and the Millennium Falcon again.
Yeah.
But of course, they hear something and they pull up the grate and there's the trio down there. And explanations are hastily given.
yeah.
No, I am the pilot. Where's the rest of them? You know, it's pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Han is genuinely surprised. The look on Han's face, and this is well acted by Harrison, is like, you know, I'm the pilot, you? He doesn't believe it, because let me just look at her. She doesn't look like a pilot. She's not dressed like a pilot. She's dressed
nope.
like a scavenger. She's dressed like a poor person. She, you know, she's wearing rags and stuff, and Han's just kind of shocked, like, you're the pilot?
Right, you're the pilot? Yeah, I'm the pilot. And then, you know, he quickly figures out where it was. It was on Jakku.
Yeah.
She stole it from Unkar Plutt, who stole it from the from the Irving brothers, who stole it from Duquesne, who stole it from Han Solo, and now Han Solo's stolen it back for good.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, that there's a great little shot when Han says, "Jakku, that junkyard," and Finn turns to Rey and he goes, "Told you, junkyard." Her facial expression is hilarious. It's like for like a split second. But if you haven't noticed this, when that scene happens and Finn turns to Rey and says, "Told you, junkyard," she looks like so offended.
Yes. She's like, "That's my home."
Yeah, exactly.
You
know, like,
you just, what?
Right. It's kind of like Yoda in Empire when he's so, you know, "My home this is."
I had it paused on that shot when you mentioned it. So I mean, it was great.
Yeah.
But you're right. And she gets very temporarily extremely offended, but she figures out it's Han Solo and everything is immediately turned to, "Oh, you're Han Solo. What, the rebellion general? No, the smuggler." You know, yeah. She knows Han for his daring do as a smuggler and as a pilot. And of course, it makes sense that Finn would know Han as, you know, one of the rebellion generals, because that's what he's been taught. Mm-hmm. Probably a person of interest, a person to be aware of, you know, as a First Order stormtrooper. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So this legend of Han Solo is twofold. He has a legend as a smuggler and as a rebellion general. But what's so great is when he says, "I used to be," you know, in Han's mind, he's none of those things now. You know, he's just making it. He's just surviving again. You know, he's really fallen back to kind of who he was in A New Hope. So Han actually, you know, Han gets redeveloped in this film.
Yeah.
And he becomes the same person he always was. But, you know, "I used to be." So, like, he does acknowledge, like, yeah, those were things that I was, but I'm not that anymore, right? Like, Han has lost his clear sense of identity to a certain degree. And then one of my favorite shots in the film is he is offended that Rey gets it wrong. He didn't do it the Kessel Run in 14 parsecs, but 12.
Right.
You know, he goes and stands on the bridge of the Falcon, and, you know, you get...
I was just about to mention this.
And
he just stands there and takes it all in.
Yeah. Yeah, that is, again, great acting by Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And
then, of course, he quickly notices that something's wrong.
Right.
Some moof milker installed a compressor.
Right. You know, I mean, Han is aboard his baby again. And it's great. It's just great seeing that smile on his face.
Right.
But, you know, they immediately start, you know, Rey starts in like, "We need your help. We need to get this droid to the resistance base." And Han's just kind of like walking past them, ignoring it, like, "My help." You know, Han's done in his mind. He's done with this. But what shakes him back to kind of the reality of the situation is when Finn says that he's carrying a map to Luke Skywalker. You knew him. And again, we've talked about this scene a lot, and I still love it. It's as close as we're going to get to Han and Luke being together again. But Han basically, like, he's waxing nostalgic here. You know, I knew him. I knew Luke. And, you know, they've got Luke's theme playing quietly in the background.
Right.
Han is remembering immediately. Like, it's just like, you know, like that experience of your life flashing before your eyes. His relationship with Luke is flashing before his eyes. And, you know, he feels a connection there, which is going to have an effect very shortly when Balateek says there's two fugitives and Han basically covers for them. You know, Han could have sold them out. He could have just kept the droid for himself. But, you know, I think for Han, he sees these characters as kind of opening him up again. They're the spark to the old Han Solo.
Yeah, they are. They've brought something back to him that he has lost, in a sense, or at least the hope that he can recover something from his past. You know, this friendship with Luke, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, reminiscing time is cut short because things start going wrong. At first, Han thinks it's one of the Rathtars got out, which is bad, but it's even worse.
It's the Guavian
Death Gang. And so Han, of course, you know, has Rey and Finn hide, and he goes to talk his way out of it. like he mm-hmm. always does.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. Every time.
Yeah. So good. But yeah, no, I mean, this scene shows how clearly Han has reinserted himself into his old smuggler ways. But I think what's different, and I actually was just thinking this this morning when I was rewatching Act Two, Balateek is a lot younger than Han, right? Like Han is in his 70s. His character is in his 70s, and this is like a young man. And what it made me think was smuggling is a young man's game.
It is.
Right? Like, I mean, that's typical of most type of crime like that, you know, smugglers. And even in our world, like usually people that are involved with stuff like that, they tend to be on the younger side.
Right.
Because it is. It's a very active lifestyle.
You don't last very long.
Right. So I think it's interesting that like Han is just what struck me is like Balateek, like he's like a young pup, you know, and he's talking to Han like he's in control. And it bothered me in a good way. It bothered me because it's like he shouldn't be talking like this to Han Solo. But to me, it kind of strikes me that like Han's really not that good at this anymore.
No.
You know, no. And it's you know, when we first met him in A New Hope, he was a top line smuggler. Like, yeah, he was in some trouble with Jabba, but also running for Jabba was like the biggest gig you could get. Now, I mean, again, we don't know anything about Balateek, and maybe we're going to get some, you know, expanded stuff about him. I could care less because I don't care about him at all. But, you know, maybe he is a big, big deal smuggler. Same with, you know, the Tasu Leech and Kanja Club. Yeah.
Right.
But it just seems like, you know, Han's just not that good at this anymore. You know, he's too old. He's out of his element at this point. And that just really struck me because, you know, these both gangs that are kind of confronting him. I mean, granted, we can't see the faces of anybody in the Guavian game except Balateek, but
right.
they all tend to be younger. Whereas Han is an old man. Like, you know, that's like somebody in their 70s, like going to be like, you know, I think now's a good time for me to start pro baseball. probably not, you know.
Right.
It's a young man's game. So Han's out of his element, which I just think again is really cool because who Han Solo is kind of rediscovered on the ship, on his home, the Falcon. He's reminded of his relationship with Luke. He's reminded of the legend he was as a rebellion general, and even as a smuggler, now he's kind of none of those things. You know,
right.
He's not a smuggler anymore, and it's clear that he's not very good at it anymore.
Right. But of course, Balateek has been immortalized in Star Wars fandom for "Tell that to Kanja Club," which is still an awesome line. But we get the confrontation between the two gangs here. Rey decides to try and help by resetting the fuses, and resets the wrong fuses. And instead of closing the blast doors, she opens the Rathtar cages.
Yeah. Good job, Rey. I guess, oops. Actually, this is the only time when she screws up in the movie, if you think about it.
Kind of.
It's her only actual mistake. Yeah. Wrong fuse.
Oh, what? Wrong fuses.
But even before she does that, right, like when they're confronting him, Balateek notices BB-8 and says the First Order is looking for a droid like that and two fugitives. And Han covers, again, like I said earlier, Han covers for them.
You know, right.
First I've heard of it. But, you know, this particular sequence, once the Rathtar battle begins, it doesn't feel very Star Wars to me. It still doesn't. And mainly because, to me, the Rathtars just don't belong. They look so stupid. I can't get over them. I think they're going for, like, a rolling Sarlacc, but...
Yeah. I was thinking about it this morning. While the design of the Rathtars I still don't particularly like, and it still feels very Star Trek to me.
Mm-hmm. As does the ship they're on. I don't like the look of that freighter.
The situation, though, I feel is a very Star Wars type situation. Mm-hmm. The circumstances, the design is a little not quite Star Wars, but the situation that we're doing here, the fact that we're trying to get away from these two gangs, so we accidentally let out the creatures, and we have this big, you know, fight scene, chase scene, where we have to not only dodge the gangs, we got to dodge the creatures and get out of here. Is a very Star Wars type situation, in my opinion. So I was just thinking about that this morning as I was watching it. So I think the situation works great. The design of some of the the creatures and, you know, the ship itself, maybe not quite so much, but I like the situation. I like the way the scene plays out.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Like, I do like the situation as well. I love specifically the kind of the verbal back and forth with Han, Balateek, and then Tasu Leash. Yeah. That is very Star Wars, very Han Solo. The only thing that's taking me out of it, again, is just the look of the freighter. The interior of that freighter looks very, like, sci-fi channel sci-fi. Like, it's not Star Wars sci-fi. It looks too utilitarian. And then, of course, the Rathars, to me, just look... They look so stupid. You know, we've gotten things like Wampas, Tauntauns, Rancars, oh my, and then the Rathars. Like, which of these doesn't belong? And I feel the same about the Borg Gullet in Rogue One. I don't like the look of the Borg Gullet either. It's basically it's a silly-looking octopus. Again, we don't like to bring negativity too much. Those are things that didn't work for me, but I'm with you, Jason. The situation works great. And when Han runs by the one member of the Guavian gang and punches it, that's a very Indiana Jones scene.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The punch itself is like such an Indiana Jones type punch.
It's like knocking the Nazi out of the blimp.
Yeah.
No ticket.
Great scene. Great scene. But, you know, they're about to get away. You know, Rey helps, you know, shows her incredible timing skills. You know, again, she can see things before they happen.
Right.
And she rescues Finn, and then Han and Chewie are having the shootout. And again, this is one thing, like...
One thing real quick. I do love how when Rey rescues Finn and she goes to, like, meet him at the door as he's, you know, wrestling the tentacles off of him. And he says, the door, it just... And she just says, that was lucky, rather than saying, yeah, I did that, you know. I thought that was... I like that little
interesting
touch.
Yeah. She doesn't, like, take credit for it.
She's like, he's like, at the door, it just, that was lucky.
So Han and Chewie, they're having this little shootout. And sadly, like, I wish the only thing about that shootout I would have liked more is Han had hit. I wish Han was shooting too. I mean, granted, yes, he is trying to work the door, but I wish Han was doing some shooting there too. The Guavian blasters sound really weird to me too. They still do. There's a couple things sound-wise in this movie that don't work for me. One is the Guavian blasters. Even the bowcaster sounds a little odd, as well as the Falcon's turrets. They don't sound anything like the Falcon's turrets when they're on Jakku. Granted, it could be new guns, but they look the same. So if they look the same, they shouldn't sound different. But anyway. So the Guavian guns are a little odd-sounding. Again, they're very like Star Trek-y sounding to me. And I don't want any Star Trek in my Star Wars, thank you very much. But, you know, Chewie gets shot, and it oddly puts him down for the count for a while, which is weird. Leia takes a shot to the shoulder like a champ in Return of the Jedi, but apparently Chewie's a baby.
those Guavian Death Gang rifles seem to be a bit more high-powered than a Stormtrooper blaster.
That's fair. So Han, you know... unloads Chewie of the bowcaster and apparently for the first time ever uses it, and he really likes it. To me, that is like the dad jokes of the film. Like, that's a dad joke, you know. And later in the film when he's like, I like this thing, like, that's such a dad joke. Works, but it's a dad joke. Which makes sense. Han's a dad.
It's true.
So they do get away
by blasting out of the hangar at light speed.
Right. Which is a very Han Solo thing to do. Again, you know, he trusts that he trusts that Falcon so much to do something like that. You know,
I love the line.
Is that even possible?
Is that even possible? I don't know. I never asked that question until after I've done it.
Yeah. That's Han Solo.
Yeah, that's Han Solo.
So then Balateek has one last moment with his beautiful accent where he says, inform the First Order that the droid is a... I don't know exactly what he says.
Han Solo has the droid aboard the Millennium Falcon or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And then we go to Starkiller Base for the first time in the movie.
Yes.
And we see Snoke for the first time in the movie via massive hologram.
Is that the first time we saw Snoke? Did we see him in Act 1?
Nope.
Okay.
It's the first time we see Snoke. And, you know, he is concerned about that news they just received. He's concerned that the Resistance is going to get that map to Skywalker, and Luke will return. He's the last Jedi. Oop, title of episode 8.
What? What?
What?
Episode 8 title? What? Yeah. No, I've mentioned this in a discussion before, but Snoke seems a bit concerned about the fact that Luke could return to the galaxy.
Yeah.
He does let on how concerned he is, but he does seem a bit distracted and a bit concerned about the possibility of Luke returning.
I would say I would almost push it into the fear category. I feel like he's almost afraid of Luke returning, which again says something about whoever Snoke is. He's probably not as powerful as Luke. So it was important that, he got Luke to go into hiding. And I think, and this is, again, all we can do is speculate at this point, but if indeed Kylo is the one who, turned on Luke's, new Jedi Order and slaughtered them all, that was Snoke's way of getting at Luke, right? Like, he couldn't openly go confront him because he's probably not strong enough to beat Luke, but crush his spirit, right? Crush his spirit and force him into exile. And that's essentially what happens. So when Snoke hears that, oh my gosh, he could come back and new Jedi would rise, that can't happen.
No.
So Hux has an immediate solution. And his
weapon.
The weapon is ready. And it's interesting too, because Snoke is like, he's flustered, right? He gets up out of his throne chair. He's flustered. And what finally calms him is Hux. Hux says, we can destroy the Republic. Like, our weapon's finally ready.
Right.
And Snoke sits back down. He kind of collects himself and says, go.
Make the preparations.
And he's, yes, Supreme Leader. And the way he looks at Kylo, like, to me, it's very clear. These are two young men, because they are. They're both about, probably their late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
Vying for Papa's, daddy's attention, in a sense, scene. And Hux is kind of like giving it to him. They're like, hey, I win this round,
Right.
And
he likes me more than you.
Right. but I also think, kind of the way he looks at Kylo and the way that even Kylo looks back is, I think there is a little bit of reluctance on Kylo's part, though, to destroy the Republic, because in his mind, his mom's still there. Right. Like,
right.
So maybe they're and we're going to hear quite a bit that he's tempted by the light. So Kylo doesn't protest, but he certainly doesn't,
offer a solution.
Exactly. So off goes Hux. And then we get the line that was in all the trailers. There's been an awakening. Have you felt it?
Yes.
Yes.
The way Snoke talks in the rest of that scene, it's very like Emperor Palpatine-y. Just like the way he like slowly says words. Like, normal people don't talk like that. You know what I mean? That's not how the normal cadence of a conversation goes.
Right.
And again, I'm not saying it's exactly Palpatine. It's certainly not. But it's just, again, it's kind of like this very dramatic way of speaking. There's something more. And he like slowly raises a finger. In the hands of your father, Han
Solo.
I don't say like, oh, this is my friend, Jason Hunt. That's how I'm going to introduce you to people at the convention in April.
There you go.
Oh, hey, everybody. How you doing? This is my friend, Jason Hunt. it's meant to draw kind of this dramatic sense, and Kylo's looking up at him. He says, "He means nothing to me," And this Snoke recognizes, though, like, well, even you, Master of the Knights of Ren. So again, we're getting some backstory. We don't know anything what the hell those things are, but
right,
Kylo's in charge of them, whatever they may be. You've never faced such a test, and
right,
it's the first time ever in Star Wars where we get the scenario where a villain is tempted and is tested by the light. So it's a really cool kind of reversal of things in a way.
It is.
This is the villain's journey. We've never had that. Well,
this is like the reverse hero's journey. Rey is starting on her own hero's journey, and like you said, it's the villain's journey. It's the reverse. It's the inverse of the hero's journey for Kylo at this point.
Right. And again, this is, you know, for obviously some of the criticism Force Awakens gets, and I know I've given it some criticism lately too, but one of this like soaring achievements of Force Awakens though is this character development, and these types of characters have never been in Star Wars before. We've never had a hero start a hero's journey while at the same time we have a character who may have been a hero who's becoming more and more of a villain.
Right.
So like that's a very unique scenario. So, you know, you've got to give credit to JJ and Lawrence Kasdan for creating something like that, because that's unique. That's unique.
Right.
You know, that particular scene ends with Kylo saying, you know, with your training, I will not be seduced. You know, that's a line we would expect to hear Luke say to Yoda about Vader's right. temptations. But here right. is Kylo again referring to the temptation of the light.
It's interesting. It's very interesting. It's, you know, it's like his upbringing, you know, as a son of Han and Leia, plus the fact that he's been trained by Luke has so, you know, and I'm speculating here, but it's like it's so accustomed him to the light that it just feels right to him, I suppose, so that when he makes the choice to go dark, that normality, that thing he's accustomed to walking in is still there trying to tempt him back.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I'm speculating a little bit on that front. I don't know. I don't know what, you know, what kind of child Ben Solo was. If he was a good kid or if he was the one that was pulling wings off insects, you know.
Right.
Well, and frying ants with the magnifying glass.
Yeah.
But
I would gather that, you know, he was a little bit of both of those things. He was somewhere in the middle, you know.
Probably.
Because Han's going to say later there was too much Vader in him. So, you know, he must have exhibited some signs of anger and aggression when he was younger.
It's just puberty, Han. It's just puberty.
Yeah, but it sounds like it might have been more than that. Anyway, so we go back on board the Falcon, where we get that iconic shot of the Falcon in the hyperspace tunnel, which we've now gotten also in Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
Although, don't we get a shot like that in the original trilogy?
We do.
It's
similar.
Hope, right?
It's not the same, but it's similar.
It's in A New Hope, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. And it's the Falcon.
It is.
Okay. So, yeah, because I remember when we saw that shot in one of the early trailers, people were like, that's so weird. We've never seen that. And it's like, actually, we have.
We have.
It just hasn't looked this cool because, obviously, computer graphics have caught up. But.
Right. We haven't, you know, started at the front of the Falcon and watched it pass us in the tunnel,
right.
but we've seen the Falcon in the hyperspace tunnel.
Yeah. So, you know, there's this little drama in the cockpit with, you know, trying to buy, you know, to fix this compressor thing that's causing the hyperdrive to potentially explode. And again, right. Rey comes to the rescue.
She pulls something out and what'd you do? I bypassed the compressor. She's so excited. She's like, isn't this great?
And Han's just like, oh.
Huh.
Yeah. And then one of my favorite lines of him in this movie is he walks out of the cockpit, move, ball.
Right.
Because BB-8's in the way.
Exactly.
We're going to get some, you know, again, like this is the Obi-Wan with Luke scene in A New Hope, you know, where the wise mentor kind of unpacks a bit of history for us.
Right.
But the first thing, though, before he even unpacks that is he thanks Finn for helping with Chewie.
Right.
So again, it's pretty clear at this point that Han somewhat cares about both of these characters. Mm-hmm. You know, he's impressed with Rey's skill as a pilot, even though he's not going to say it. And he's appreciative of how, you know, Finn has just helped Chewie. But, you know, Rey makes the introduction of Finn's with the Resistance. I'm just a scavenger. When she says he's with the Resistance, like, Finn looks at him like, oh, shit. And,
right.
and Han looks at him like, he doesn't buy it. Not even a little.
Nope. No, not at all.
But it's interesting, you know, that Rey just identifies herself as a scavenger. Because we're going to find out that she's so much more than that.
Right.
But, you know, BB-8 shows... Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, we get the map.
Yeah.
And Han immediately recognizes that it's incomplete. And he's walking around like he's trying to identify, you know, what some of these planets are, where they're at. But there's just not enough information for him. But we start getting some of the history of Luke and the Jedi and all this stuff. You know, it was real. You know, it's real. All the Sith, the Jedi, the light and the dark, it's real. All of it, you know. We get that line from the trailer. We get, you know, the fact that Luke is probably out trying to hunt down the first Jedi temple, you know, because of what happened to his Jedi order. And we get that story here of what happened to Luke's Jedi order. So it's, we get a lot of history packed into like 2 minutes with this scene.
Yes, we do. Yeah. So we do. I mean, and I think it was good for us, you know, fans who particularly enjoyed the EU and, you know, specifically where Luke took the Jedi Order in the EU, right? Like he basically rebuilds the Order. It's not exactly the same as it was in the, you know, Old Republic, but it's massive and it's influential. So to come 30 years later and find out that not only are there no Jedi, but Luke's gone. But Han makes sense of it for us very quickly. You know, he was training a new generation of Jedi, and mm-hmm. one of his students turned on him, betrayed it, and destroyed it all. Now, again, we are all assuming that that's Kylo. It doesn't mean it is. It could be Snoke. I don't think it's Snoke because, you know, if it was just a random student, I think Luke would have confronted him and potentially killed him. I think it needs that familial connection, where is what makes Luke kind of reluctant to take up arms and just, again, feel that weight of that responsibility. Because we learn from Leia a little bit later in the film that Kylo was specifically sent to train with Luke. And if you've read Bloodline, we know that they're off together for most of the, in that entire novel, Ben and Luke are off together doing something, training or something.
Right.
So there was obviously a clear connection between Luke and Ben, and it goes wrong. So it makes sense that Luke feels that tremendous guilt. You know, just like Obi-Wan does with Anakin, you know, mm-hmm. I was doing a presentation at work last night on Return of the Jedi and watching the clip where, you know, Obi-Wan says, you know, Anakin was a good friend, you know, the way he's just looking off into space, like remembering like how good of friends they were. I think Obi-Wan still, even in Return of the Jedi, feels a tremendous amount of guilt for how Anakin falls. And it's clear that Luke feels that with Ben's probable fall. So he's, you know, he's off trying to find the first Jedi temple, and probably, again, we're going to get reasoning for all of that, I'm sure, in episode 8, but my speculation is he's looking for guidance. You know, he's looking for a clear way of moving forward now, because
guidance, inspiration, you know, where do I go from here?
Yeah. Because I failed. I didn't do this right. What do I need to do now? And I'm kind of hoping that's what we get. I hope we get a sense of how long he's been away, which I think we will. And that he doesn't just leave to leave for good. Like, I hope he left with a purpose, right? Like, he's disappeared. And the reason he didn't tell anybody where he was going is because he didn't want to be tracked down. He is, you know, dedicated to that mission, just like Obi-Wan, you know, if you think about it in the original trilogy. It's his only purpose now is to keep Luke safe. Well, my hope is in the sequel trilogy, at the beginning here, Luke's purpose is to figure out how to build the Jedi correctly or where to move forward. You know, I think it'll be a failure of Luke's character if we just learn, like, he just felt guilty, so he left. Now, from Han's perspective, that would make sense. Like, you know, for Han and probably a lot of his friends, they just think, like, wow, Luke just feels responsible, so he's done. He's called quits. But I really hope that there's more reasoning behind that. And sorry, I'm really like going on tangents here. But in Rey's vision, when we see the scene with Luke putting his hand on R2, even though that's all it is just a hand on him, to me, it's not just a hand of like, seal, you know, I'm leaving for good, buddy. It's more of like, I have something I have to do now, but I have to leave you behind. And I know that's reading a lot into a very simple image, but to me, I'm really hoping that the reason Luke left is because he has a purpose. Because that's who Luke Skywalker is. That's the Luke we met in the original trilogy. And I think it would do a disservice to his character if it's just, well, he left because he's depressed and he feels bad. Like, Luke's been through hell in the original trilogy and still sticks around and fights through all of it. Like, that's not who Luke is, to just give up. So I'm really hoping that he left with a purpose.
Right. Yeah, and I'm like you, I'm hoping we get, and I'm sure we will get, a lot of that reasoning in Episode 8. Because right now, the only people who are talking about it can only really speculate. Mm-hmm. And they don't know the full story. They don't know his full motivations. And they don't know what in the Force might be driving him. So, that being said, we're arriving on Takodana, where Han is going to try and get BB-8 on a clean ship.
It is worth noting, and I know you kind of insinuated it, but Han isn't a skeptic anymore, right?
Right.
He's almost in the exact spot. He's just not sitting in the chair, but almost the exact spot in where in A New Hope he says it's a bunch of hokey religions and ain't.
Yeah.
And he doesn't believe in it. And now almost in the exact same spot, like 45 years later, he's there to confirm it's indeed true. You know, while he himself isn't part of it, he has seen it, he knows it, and he confirms it.
Yeah.
And that's huge. That's huge. And I love the look on Rey's face. She's just so wide-eyed. Like,
yeah.
Loving it. Loving that it's real.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And of course, you know, that wide-eyed look continues when they're, you know, coming into land on Takodana, and she's just like, I never imagined there was so much green in the whole galaxy, you know?
Yeah.
It's she's been on Jakku a long time.
Yeah. Han's like, well, welcome to Ireland then. You've never seen this much green. Oh, Barlarney. Sorry. I'm not very good at accents, if you couldn't tell.
this wasn't Ireland.
Good, Jason. That was better than mine, but that's not saying much.
This wasn't Ireland.
There we go.
there we go. All right. Anyway, so, let's go back to the movie.
so they land on Takodana, and there's this great little shot of Rey. She runs off of the ship. You know, just like it's like arriving at Celebration, right? Like, you just want to get in there. And me, every time I go to Toys R Us, just running in, you know? and, you know, and she just stands there for a second and closes her eyes and just feels the sun, feels the breeze. You know, like, this is such a new climate for her. And it's really cool how she just
smells.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's a kind of a rebirth scene in a way, you know. She's entered a new reality.
She's taken her steps into a larger world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as they're getting ready to disembark, we get the nice little this funny scene between Finn and Han, where Finn is trying to assert himself as a big deal in the rebellion, and he calls him Solo. Did you just call me Solo? I'm sorry, sir.
Mr. Solo.
Mr. Solo, sir, you know, and he's, you know, trying to make this idea that he's a big deal in the resistance and he needs to know if there's any first order sympathizers and all that stuff here. And I was just like, one thing about women, so always find out the truth. You got a bigger problem. Always find out the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
That completely pops Finn's bubble.
Yeah. Han doesn't even respond to his immediate concern. He's just saying, there's a bigger picture here. That girl that you're sweet on, she's going to find out you're lying to her.
Right. Han doesn't believe a bit of this, this gobbledygook.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I love it.
So Han comes out and brings a particular, you know, blaster to Rey and essentially invites her into his crew. This is her, this is, well, in a sense, it's her second call to adventure. She gets three in the movie. You know, the first one is BB-8, you know, it's a little more unclear, but this one's a very clear call to adventure. Hey, I'm looking to bring on more people into my crew. What do you say? She refuses because she needs to go back, home. You know, because for her, home is this physical place called Jakku.
Right.
And, you know, I've already been away too long. Again, she still is like holding out hope that her family will return for her, whoever that may be.
Right.
And again, that just, it's sad, but it makes sense. Like that, you know, for the past large proportion of her life, that's just what, that's her belief system. Her belief right. is that that's where I need to be. That's where home will eventually be for me, you know, but I can just hear Yoda right now. Unlearn what you have learned.
Right.
You know, she has to let go of that, which we're going to get a little bit later when she talks to Maz, but Han just, you know, when she says, you know, I have to get back home, and Han goes, what, Jakku? Right? Like, even Han recognizes that's not home. Like,
right.
But he doesn't force it, right? Like, just like Obi-Wan with Luke, you know, you must do what you feel is right. He doesn't say anything like that, yeah. But
it's a shame. Chewie really liked you.
Yeah. So, like, again, that's such an important part, you know, and we've done something on this in a previous episode, but when somebody invites the hero on their adventure, like, it can never be a coercion. It can never be a forced invitation. It has to always be open, and it has right. to be a free response. And Rey's not there yet. She's still, nope, I got to get back home.
Exactly. Exactly.
And well, actually I'm going to save this till a little bit later. I have something to say about visuals in the movie.
Okay.
But I'll save it.
All right. Well, we get to Maz's castle, and of course Han tells them not to stare at what? Any of it. And they go inside, and we get our introduction to Maz Kanata, which is one of the best things in this movie. I love Maz so much. Han Solo! She just calls across from across the room, and everyone stops. And Han's response is, oh boy. Hey, Maz.
Where's my boyfriend?
Where's my boyfriend? Chewie's back on the Falcon.
Chewie's working on the ship. I like that Wookiee.
I like that Wookiee. She's great.
Oh, yeah. And when we come into Maz's castle, you know, I mean, this is, again, it's a Cambellian part of Rey's journey. You know, it's the same thing of Luke entering the cantina and Maz Eisley. But we get a kind of a crawl shot, if you will. What is that? What would you call it? A panning shot, maybe?
But a tracking shot
all through it, right?
Yeah.
Which that was kind of, again, this is a different type of visual. Like when we go to the Mos Eisley Cantina, George decided to use montages, which I think works better because it makes everything feel bigger, more diverse. We get a clearer sense of the room with Maz's. We do get montage later, very shortly later.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, we get this great bombastic introduction to Maz Kanata, and Rey's entered a new world. You know, I mean,
yeah.
This is not only is Jakku a different type of planet, but Maz's castle is a very different setting. She's probably never seen this many people in one place before.
No,
you know, Nima Outpost,
not
even
this many diverse, you know, types of people.
Right, right.
So,
I mean, we can assume that Jakku is certainly has some sense of diversity because she's able to understand droids. She's able to understand Chewie, you know, so she certainly grew up around some level of diversity, but not quite like this.
No.
And also probably a new concept to her is that people can hang out just to hang out, right? Like Nima Outpost, it's only a gathering place because people are just trying to survive. They're there trading for goods and for livelihood.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of downtime, it seems like, or recreational time. But that's exactly what all these people are there for. They're there to just take a load off.
Right, pretty much. it's a weird bunch.
Yeah.
It's a weird bunch.
Have you read the second Aftermath novel yet?
No.
Okay. Well, I don't care. I'm going to spoil something.
Go ahead.
It's small. So in those novels, there are always like these interlude sections, which take you out of the story, but, you know, just essentially to give you a sense of the galaxy at large. And there's an interlude in the second Aftermath novel at Maz's castle.
Ah.
And we learn that Maz has a sign up where it basically says, all are welcome, on only one rule, no fighting. If you fight, you get kicked out. So, and it's really interesting because when we do go into Maz's castle here, there's obviously like spies for the First Order and the Resistance there. Maz does not. She never closes her doors to anybody, but she does have a rule that there can be no conflict, and that's what happens in the interlude. So I'm sorry if you haven't read this; I'm spoiling it. There's a fight, and Maz gives the person a decision. I don't remember what the decision is, so luckily I can't spoil that for you. But that's the only rule. If you fight, you get kicked out, or something else happens to you. But it's that's the only time like anything negative will happen.
You know what? You know what happens to you? Boogle it. Boogle it. Boogle it.
Oh man, that's great. But yeah, so you know, Maz's castle is great. It's this place where, again, all are welcome. You just can't fight.
No fighting. So
you can be on different sides. I mean, there could even be the potential of a rebellion soldier sitting next to a First Order stormtrooper. Maz allows it. She doesn't pick sides. Right. And again, I love Maz Kanata. I really hope we get a little bit more of her in episode 8.
Oh, me too.
I mean, luckily she's on the cast list, so she's bound to be in it.
Yes. Yes. But we do get those spies that you're mentioning. You know, both the Resistance and the First Order have spies working for them in this area, and they both notice BB-8 and both report back. So,
And what's interesting is when the Resistance droid sees BB-8, that's the first time we actually hear March of the Resistance. It's a very light, it's played very lightly in the background. It's obviously not loud and bombastic, but we hear do 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 do, like we just hear a few of the notes. So that's actually the first time we hear March of Resistance in the Force.
It is. It's true.
But then we get this incredible scene with Kylo. This is probably my favorite Kylo Ren scene in the movie. And it's just so good. Like, this is somebody who's really struggling, but what he's struggling with is being a good person. You know, in a sense.
Right.
His struggle is with the light. You know, and he confesses, we don't know who he's talking to initially, but he confesses that the Supreme Leader can sense it. You know, he can sense that Kylo is a little bit weak here. And he's asking, you know, show me again the power of the darkness. You know, he's pleading, which we then see is Darth Vader's mask. He's pleading with his grandfather to show him the power of the darkness. And
not sure that's the right person to ask. Yeah. Kylo. Just saying.
But Kylo's purpose, for some reason, and again, hopefully we'll get this between 8 and 9, is Kylo wants to finish what Vader started, which we've talked about. You know, we talked about this last year when the movie first came out, but I think both of our readings is what Vader started was the eradication of the Jedi Order.
Yeah.
You know, the Empire was the Emperor's thing. Vader's thing was the eradication of the Jedi.
Yeah. That was his mission. Yeah. Given to him by the Emperor, but that was his mission, and he was the one that was running around the galaxy hunting down these remaining Jedi, as we see a little bit in Rebels.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And, you know, even early in the film, you know, Hux tells Kylo, make sure that your personal interests not interfere with leaders, you know, orders from Leader Snoke. Like, Kylo's mission in all of this is to track down Luke and kill him. You know, that's his goal, is the eradication of the last Jedi. But for some reason, you know, getting this close, right? Like, it's clear that he's really, really close to that happening now. It's bringing up feelings, though. You know, it's bringing up the goodness that still resides in him, and he's struggling with it.
Yeah.
And he's pleading to the mask of a dead man.
Yeah. And it's a little creepy, but it's really awesome, too. You know, it's, you know, makes you wonder what other kind of gruesome artifacts Kylo's collected over the years.
Yeah, it's all.
When did he get that helmet? Did Luke take him to Endor at some point to, you know, pay homage to Anakin at some point, and that's where he knew about the helmet? Or, you know, was it collected by somebody else and Kylo acquired it, you know, later? You know, who knows at this point? It's like, I kind of want to know how he got that helmet.
Yeah, you know, well, I think there is a story about the spy that's in Maz's castle, supposedly the one that finds it and gives it to him.
Okay.
So I don't know how, but again, how did he know it was there is the other thing, right? Like,
right.
There is a good, that would be really cool though, if Luke did take him there to see that. But yeah, this is definitely my favorite Kylo Ren scene in the movie. And some great helmet acting.
Yes.
Forgive me. I feel it again. The pull to the light. Supreme Leader senses it. Show me again the power of the darkness. And I will let nothing stand in our way. Show me. Grandfather. And I will finish what you started.
Great statement of the Imperial March there.
It is.
I love that scene. And, Kylo is, he's essentially praying to a false god, to a fake god, in a sense, which I just think is really cool because there's language like that all throughout the Old Testament about how, all of the Gentile people pray to wooden gods and bronze gods, essentially saying like all their statues are just fake because those gods aren't real. And here is Kylo worshiping a helmet of a dead person, you know? So like there's no power there, what he's seeking, he's not going to find there. So I just think that's really cool. But anyway, back to Maz, she,
Han's trying to get Maz to help send BB-8, back to the resistance, and she's like, no, that's your job. Mm-hmm. You need to go home.
Mm-hmm.
You need to quit running. You've run too long. She's basically telling him to, man up and go back and take care of your responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So again,
he's like, I don't want to do that.
Right. So the concept of home again comes up. Han's not at home.
Leia's not there.
Yeah, Leia's not there. Chewie, we're home. Still not quite.
Not quite.
And that's
not according to Maz.
That's why I love Maz Kanata, because she's the truth bearer in the film. She calls it out. Not going to do that. You need to go home.
Exactly. You want to? You think Maz and Leia know each other?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because the way he says to her, like, Leia doesn't want to see me. Like, he says that, like, she knows Leia, and not just casually. Not like, oh, I know who she is as a person. Like, they've had an interaction. Doesn't mean that they're, like, good friends or anything like that, but it's clear that Leia knows who Maz is. So I like that, she tells him he has to go back home. And then Maz goes into this, she is the one who sees the big picture. She is very much the Yoda figure of the movie. Han's the Ben Kenobi, but she's the Yoda. And what happens there is, Yoda is always, when he's training Luke, he's always keeping the big picture in mind, right? Like when Luke is leaving an Empire, in a rush, and they're both concerned that he's going to either be killed or fall to the dark side. Yoda says, stopped, they must be. On this all depends. Stopped, they must be. He's referring to Vader and the Emperor. Like, that's the big picture. That's, like, yes, you're here to become a Jedi, but that has, and the reason that's so important is because it has a galaxy-wide impact. If you're able to do that, you will be strong enough to confront these two. You're not there yet.
Right.
So I like that Maz is giving us the big picture here of saying, like, we all need to resist the First Order and fight them. And, which keeps referring to this fight, and Rey says, what fight? And
yeah,
the fight against the
only
dark
one that ever matters.
Yeah.
The light versus the dark.
Yeah.
And she's seen the fight against the darkness, I think is what she says. And
she just says dark side.
Yeah. The dark side. And then of course she describes the different faces it has taken over the years, the Sith, the Empire. Now it's the First Order. So
we must face them, fight them. all of us. Now cue the Rogue One theme.
Or the Resistance theme.
Yeah.
Resistance theme. So,
but again, Finn pipes in and says, "There is no fight against the First Order that we can win."
Right.
Again, he is so convinced that they are unbeatable. He thinks they're the New England Patriots of the Star Wars galaxy, you know, so he's terrified of them. And, you know, he'd rather run than fight. Right. That's, you know, Finn, for some reason, just even though his whole life has been trained to be a soldier, he'd rather run and live than fight and probably die in his mind.
Right.
So he decides to leave. Rey is clearly disappointed.
Oh,
and
very.
Maz says, "Who's the girl?"
Although we did miss the little scene where she looks into his eyes.
Yeah, that's true.
She crawls across the table. You know, adjusts her goggles, crawls across the table, and looks into his eyes.
What is she doing? I don't know, but it ain't good.
Right. You see the same eyes in different people. And she identifies him, you know, as a man who wants to run. And it's interesting. Some of this conversation, I think, is starting to make Rey look at Finn like, what's going on? You're not you're with the Resistance, why are you so adamant that the First Order can't be defeated? You know?
Yeah. And come on, bro. We have a mission.
Exactly. Exactly. But of course
he marches off and Rey goes off after him, and Maz says, "Who's the girl?" And then we cut away. It's very debatable what Han might say there. You know, it could be something as simple as like some scavenger I found on Jakku, or she's my daughter, or it's Luke's daughter, or it's Obi-Wan Kenobi's granddaughter, which would be stupid as hell. You know, it's
Obi-Wan's not going to hook up with anyone on Tatooine, especially after what happened to Satine.
Right. It's Nian Num's daughter. We don't know.
That's weird.
It's Bib Fortuna's niece, you know. but we don't know what he says. I think he says something, though, because it causes Maz to go looking for Rey.
Right.
Right. Like, you could say, yeah, maybe it was the Force that, like, tells her, like, hey, you need to go down to the basement. And I think that's part of it, too. But I think also.
Well, I think she's kind of responsible for, you know, setting up the opportunity to have, you know, the lightsaber reach out to Rey. I feel like she's, you know, left that door open, you know, the literal door open, you know, to the basement area for Rey to go down and to explore. And of course that when she goes down to the basement, there's that door the door to the closet that opens, you know, for her. And I'm pretty sure Maz has something to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
she
could probably sense the lightsaber is calling to Rey. And so she's there helping to facilitate Rey's discovery.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, she obviously has a cassette tape of little girls saying no, and she hit play on that, you know, and it's very echoey because of it's in a basement. So
right.
So she's like, guys, cue the little girl cassette.
Right. It's just a little creepy.
But before she heads down there, she does confront Finn, where Finn finally tells her the truth.
Right.
And we learn a little bit about the First Order in that, you know, that they're kind of like the Jedi. They take you from a family you never knew and raise you to do one thing, kill, you know, fight for the First Order. So, you know, Finn is well aware of what the First Order is and capable of. And he says, you know, I chose not to fight for them because I don't believe in them. But I'm also not going to fight against them. You know, I'm done with them, but I'm also just done with this.
Right.
So I'm going to leave. Come with me. Like,
he's going to try and find his own corner of the galaxy and want nothing else to do with the First Order.
Right. Right. So I guess you could even say this is another invitation to Rey. Luckily, she does reject this one.
Yes.
You know, it's really, I always really liked that speech, especially the first few times I saw it, where Finn says, you know, You know, I was ashamed of myself until I saw you, you know. And, you know, his encounter with Ray really changes him, too, you know.
Yeah.
She calls out an honesty in him that he appreciates. So, again, the importance of that character dynamic. And, you know, she's not going to go with him, though. So, you know, okay, well, you know, good luck. You know, he's sad, but he's leaving. And I love the shot when he leaves, when he's walking out the front door. Ray is watching at first, but then she starts to hear the cassette tape from Maz's basement.
Right.
And she leaves to, you know, pursue that sound. And there's a quick shot of Finn looking back. Ray's not there anymore. And he looks, you know, kind of sad. Like, oh my
Dejected.
God, she forgot me already. Right. It's probably a little bit of that. Like, wow. So I guess she's done with me. So, but that's, again, just like a great little shot. Like, we don't need that, but it was great to have because we see how much Finn is. Not only sad she's not coming, but immediately in that moment, he's like, oh my God, she forgot me, you know, which sucks even more.
Right. But we do get down to Maz's basement.
The slowest walk in the history of filmmaking. I always fast forward her like slow travels down there. takes like 30 seconds for her to walk down the stairs. It's so boring. So I always fast forward it. It's purposeful, kind of, right? Like it's meant to.
It's freaky for her,
right?
You know,
it's meant to build suspense too. But I know where I know where it goes. So now I just fast forward it.
and I do have to say, the first time I saw this movie, when she grabs the lightsaber, and we hear the sound of it igniting, I jumped.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I was like, oh God.
Yeah.
You know,
it's but then so of course loud.
It's so loud, and everything else has been so quiet up until that point. But then we get this vision that she has. And we've talked about this vision quite a bit in our Force Awakens discussion. So I don't know how deep we want to get into it here. But we do get, you know, Bespin, and we hear Luke saying no.
We have Yoda saying stuff. We have Obi-Wan saying stuff. What does Yoda say first? Oh,
see Luke and R2?
Yeah. What does Yoda say?
Crap. Energy surrounds us. You know, he's talking about the Force.
Yeah.
Something from that little speech there.
Right. And then she hears Luke yell no and sees him put his hand on R2.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the guy gets stabbed, you hear old Ben Kenobi say, "You will be tempted."
Yeah.
And that's almost like referencing Kylo.
Right.
And, you know, to me, the cool shot of the vision is like all these bodies and then the Knights of Ren with.
Right.
I still am curious if that's the Jedi Academy in the background, because when the lightning flashes, you see a building in the background that kind of looks like Jabba's Palace. I know it's not Jabba's Palace. But
right.
It just makes me wonder where they are. It may not be that they're slaughtering Jedi. They could just be slaughtering random people. Well, not random.
Right.
There's going to be a purpose to it, but it doesn't mean that they're Jedi.
Right.
But, you know, I always interpreted that stab through the chest as him rescuing Rey. So, like, he knows Rey.
I don't know. I'm still not convinced of that one. But, yeah, it that is one of the most intriguing parts of the vision is the stuff with Kylo and the Knights of Ren. But then, you know, she jumps immediately from the dark and the rain to the bright sunshine of Jakku. And she sees what I'm assuming is herself as a young girl being taken and held by Unkar Plutt while a ship leaves Jakku. And then she sees herself on Starkiller Base against Kylo, and we hear Obi-Wan say, "Rey, these are your first steps."
Yeah, it's a nice mashup of Alec and Ewan.
Yes.
I mean, we can talk about this vision forever, but all we can do is speculate, and we've done it a ton.
Right.
But it definitely seems like it's some of the past and some of the future, because – you know, Kylo coming right up in her face like that on Starkiller Base. She's about to face him literally in her face here on Takodana, and then again on Starkiller Base.
Right.
Which, by the way, can we agree that Starkiller Base was Ilum?
Oh.
I mean, I'm not the original person to think this. I've heard it elsewhere, but I really think it is the planet Ilum.
That is intriguing and entirely possible.
Right. They found a way to harness what's left of the Kybers buried within it to make a powerful weapon. I mean, it's a similar type of weapon to the Death Star, which runs on Kybers.
Oh, my gosh.
So
I love that connection.
Yeah. It doesn't mean it is, because, again, like in the Ahsoka novel, when she goes to Ilum towards the end of the book to get some crystals, like it's already being excavated, just like Jedi was. So who knows if there's anything left, but it would make sense that it could be Ilum.
Right. And she even says that, you know, there's a huge scar now running across the surface of Ilum, that you can see it from space. And
maybe they started there.
Maybe that's where they started, and maybe that's where they now have the weapon installed.
Yeah.
Jeez. Wow. So, I had not made that connection.
I hope it is, but
that would be cool.
Yeah, it would be. But
oh man.
So anyway, Rey stumbles out of her vision. Literally, I mean, it knocks her off her feet. You know.
Right.
It's too much to handle, which makes sense. She doesn't know what the heck most of that stuff is.
Right.
But here comes Maz, and she says that, you know, what was that? You know, that was Luke's lightsaber, you know, and his father's before him, and now it calls to you. You know, and this idea of, it's not the lightsaber, the device that calls to her, it's the Kyber. And again, we've gotten so much of this Kyber stuff, first in the Clone Wars, you know, with the episode on Ilum, with the younglings.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten the sense that Kybers speak to you because of Rogue One. You know, so it would make
the Ahsoka novel, and you know, now we get it here, and
So the Ahsoka novel too, like those Kybers were in the, you know, the Inquisitor's lightsaber that she defeats.
Yeah.
So it's possible, and again, I hate saying this, but it's obviously very possible that just because the Skywalker Kyber is calling to Rey doesn't mean she's a Skywalker. It could just be that it's a Kyber that connects with heroic characters. I really hope she's related to the Skywalker family.
I hope so too.
But my sense of that is quickly decreasing. But again,
are you reading spoilers?
No, I'm not. I do if I can find any. There hasn't been anything substantial about this yet.
Okay.
There's been a few things, but they're really out there. I don't think they're accurate. I'm not going to share them in case they are. I don't want to piss anyone off.
Right.
But, yeah, I just don't. And it's more so in light of Force Awakens that I don't think so.
Okay.
And just things I've heard about, like Kathleen Kennedy saying, like in meetings, I think it'd be great if Rey was a nobody. And it's just like, couldn't disagree with you more, Kathleen. So I don't care that it's not because, like, I have an issue with her being a nobody. It's the issue with, like, she's obviously the new hero. Like, it should be important. If this is the Skywalker saga, she ought to be a Skywalker. Anyway, though, we will find out in hopefully within the year.
Right. Right.
But what's cool is that the Kyber does call to her.
Yes.
And Maz recognizes that. And this is kind of the final invitation to Rey. Of, you know, what you were seeking, what you were waiting for, that's never going to happen. That's a pipe dream. But there's someone who still could come for you. It's clear that it's Luke.
Right. And Rey is the one who recognizes who it is, you know, Luke. And unfortunately, you know, here Rey again decides to reject it. You know, she has to get back to Jakku. She can't handle everything that's going on around her right now. You know?
Yeah.
And so she takes off.
So, yeah. So she can't handle this. She takes off. This is one of my favorite scenes in Force Awakens, though, with, you know, Maz with her Yoda stuff. You know, I'm no Jedi, but I know the Force.
Yeah.
And again, we've gotten this very much so even more now, like that the Force speaks to all people. Jedi have a specific relationship with it. They can harness it and use it in a certain way that others can't. But the Force communicates with everyone. And Maz is following the will of the Force here. It's led her to invite Rey to Luke. I mean, it's not Maz's job to train Rey, but she's going to point her in the right direction. But Rey's just too overwhelmed, so she flees.
Yeah.
And then we go to...
Never touching that thing again.
Yeah. And then we go to potentially Ilum, Starkiller Base.
Right.
And, you know, we get Hux's pretty intense speech.
Pretty intense?
And yeah, I love it. I think it's great. He delivered the, you know, Domhnall Gleeson crushes this. And he makes this vow that all the systems are going to bow down to the First Order.
Right.
And in his eyes, the Republic is kind of this chaotic mess. And, you know, in the eyes of the First Order, the Republic is doing no good for the galaxy. It's a broken, flawed system.
Right.
So this will bring the end to the Republic. You know, it's looking at a system that they think is broken and corrupt. So their answer is tyranny. You know, that is very historically accurate. Looking
yes.
at Hitler, looking at the Roman Empire, right?
Mm-hmm.
The republics fail when others think that it's not working. So you have power-hungry people who say, I'll fix this and take control. And what happens is tyranny. So, and this is great that we have this in Force Awakens. I don't think it's meant to be any sort of contemporary commentary.
No.
But it's very clearly, like George Lucas did with his original films, is it's a commentary on history at large. And,
yes.
you know, like when he wrote the idea of the Empire, specifically in the prequels, it was to show how does a republic die and an empire rise. And that's straight out of Roman history.
Oh, yeah.
And
of course, with the First Order here, it's right out of Nazi history. You
yeah.
know, everybody looks like they're Nazis, you know.
Exactly.
And they all the soldiers, you know, do a very Nazi-esque salute. It's not quite a Nazi salute, but it's a Nazi-esque salute.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is straight out of, you know, pre-World War II Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, of course, they fire the weapon on Starkiller Base, and we see planets just obliterated. Entire systems obliterated, including Hosnian Prime, which is the current capital of the New Republic.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when Han sees this, he looks distraught because probably he assumes Leia's there.
Right. She could be.
So and they've been estranged for a little while now, at least.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know exactly where she is, but I mean, it's clear. And if you read Bloodline, she's still there on Hosnian Prime, you know, as a senator. So she certainly, it wouldn't be weird for her to be there. So,
right.
you know, when Han looks up and sees that, I think there is some sense of like, oh my gosh, did Leia just get killed?
Right.
He doesn't know.
Yeah.
So, essentially what we get then is Rey's running off, but as she runs off, you get this great shot though, and I've always loved this shot of the TIE fighters in the landing. I love those landing craft, by the way. That looks just like the landing craft like in D-Day, that you know that the Allied forces used. Not just on D-Day. I mean, we used it in Iwo Jima, all over the World War II campaigns, but those ships just, they're so cool how steeped in, you know, history they are.
Right.
And you know, Rey sees this, you can see the look of panic on her face, and she runs back because that's where her friends are. She's going to do what she can to help.
Yeah.
And
then Maz hands over the lightsaber to Finn to give to Rey, and Han's a bit flustered because where'd you get that?
Yeah.
A good question for another time.
For another movie.
Right. Exactly.
Read the book. It's going to be a Marvel series. No, I'm kidding. But Han recognizes it too because he used that bad boy to cut open a Tauntaun.
He did. That is
like,
very true.
You know, hey, Luke, you want to get into a Tauntaun blanket? Mm.
And then the battle begins.
The Battle of Takodana, which is one of my favorite Star Wars battles of all time. And, you know, Rey's the first one to kind of draw down on some stormtroopers, and we learn that she's a pretty good shot.
Yeah. At least that second shot is.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But, so she's
a better shot than the stormtroopers.
That's for darn sure. But then we get kind of this really weird angled shot of Kylo, and he finds out that there's a girl heading west, you know, and he immediately leaves to go deal with that.
Yes.
Then out comes Han and Chewie, and Han is still just a dead-eye badass, you know? I mean, that's some of my favorite Han action scene right there is just watching him just take out those stormtroopers. One-shot kills. I mean, that's Han Solo.
Yeah.
He doesn't miss. He again, some more use of the bowcaster. He likes that thing, the dad joke.
He does.
But then we get Finn, who's looking for a weapon.
Right.
And
Maz is like, you've got one.
Yeah.
And it's the lightsaber. And he goes, oh. And he pushes the wrong button to ignite it. But I'll overlook that this time. But he's pretty good with it. Right. You know, he's not a Jedi with it, obviously. He's using it more like a stormtrooper would use their melee weapons. But he's pretty good with it. And then, of course, he runs across his, you know, former squad mate, traitor, and they have their fight, which is pretty cool.
It's a really cool fight. I mean, it's the first time we have a non-Jedi fighting a non-Jedi. I mean, we have melee fights in the Clone Wars, you know, with Maul and Pre Vizsla and Obi-Wan. Does he fight Obi-Wan?
Yes.
Yeah. But there's always at least a Jedi involved.
And this time there isn't. Finn does pretty good, but he's not the best at this, and is only saved by a bowcaster shot from Han.
But they're immediately captured, and we get, you know, my favorite rescue scene in Star Wars with the triumphant, you know, march of the resistance. Here they come into battle, and they're going to come save the day. It's the resistance.
And then we get those awesome shots of the X-Wings flying over the lake. See?
Yeah. Great, 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 great scene. And they just come in, you know, with Poe leading the charge. Go straight at them. Don't let them scare you. You know, Poe's not intimidated.
Not at all.
It's
obvious that he's not intimidated because he's the best pilot out there. Because, you know, we get that incredible shot where he takes out 10 TIE fighters and a bunch of stormtroopers.
One thing I noticed, though, when I was watching again this morning was the sound of the X-Wing cannons. They sound a little different. Mm-hmm. And I actually kind of like them, though, because they sound like the machine guns in a World War II fighter. So again, you know, when George Lucas first had the idea of dogfights, he always threw together these old, you know, World War II footage of dogfights.
Right.
And this feels very World War II. And even the way they kind of like splinter off pieces of TIE fighters, that's like what a machine gun would do to, you know, an aircraft. And it's really World War II fighting in that style, and I really like that. I really like that a lot. You know, in space, whenever they get destroyed, they just blow up. And they do blow up to some degree here. Maybe that's just because they're in space, right? There's the vacuum. I don't know. Maybe it causes explosions. But this particular fight, to me, it just really made me think of, like, you know, a World War II aircraft with its, like, strafing-run machine guns.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
We get the sequence where Kylo is freaking Rey out with that lightsaber in the woods.
Yeah.
Is a great scene.
Right. I wrote a note that I wrote, Kylo is like a predator stalking his prey. Ray with a P.
Prey.
Prey.
And that shot where he comes out from behind the rock and igniting his lightsaber right there in front of Ray is a freaky shot.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
The way he's stalking her, he's not just, you know, hunting her. He's stalking her and he's toying with her. And it's creepy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like him. He's scary.
Yeah. It works so well, though.
It does.
And he's going to, again, use his mind probe ability to determine that she has seen that map, which apparently Kylo thinks she must have a, you know, photographic memory, because he says, you know, we found what we came for. You know, forget the droid. We have what we need.
Right. Well, excuse me. It's because they have the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and he knows that.
Yeah. So they just need this last piece. And I don't know if maybe, you know, he thinks he can, like, see it in her mind, you know, with a deeper probe, or if he can, or if she can tell him what she's seen. But it's probably something, you know, along those lines.
Yeah.
So he's going to take her.
And Han sees it first, and we can just see the look on his face. Like, Han is troubled, you know, seeing his son like this. It's debatable the last, you know, we don't know the last time he saw his son, and debatable whether he's ever seen his son dressed as Kylo in the flesh.
Right.
We don't know. And he is clearly shaken up, but nothing like Finn. And again, we just talked this scene in the last episode, but when Finn goes running after her and he's completely helpless to save her, you know, your heart just goes out to him and you feel his pain.
Yeah.
But we're going to end Act 2 with this final scene where Leia shows up with the Resistance soldiers. And Han and Leia are reunited.
Yeah.
And plastic C-3PO shows up.
No.
He looks so bad in this movie. The costume looks terrible. And I'm happy to say that even both Scott Rifen and Steve Glosson have gone on rants about this quite a bit. So I'm glad that they even agree. but it is funny, you know, Han Solo.
It is I, C-3PO. You probably didn't recognize me because of the red arm. Oh, look who it is. It's... come along, BB-8.
Yeah, and, you know, Han and Leia, it's not that... this scene is just, you know, you get their theme together, and it's this really great scene where it's... They obviously haven't seen each other in a while.
Right.
Chewie walks right up and gives her a hug and then looks back at Han and kind of growls like, yo, you should be doing this too, bro.
Right. Like, right.
But Han's also like, he's in shock a little bit. You know, Leia, I saw him. I saw her son.
Yeah.
You know, he was here. And it's just like, that's clearly where the tension lies for them. Like, why aren't they together right now? Well, it's very clear from Han's just own shooken up nature. Like, that Kylo really shook that marriage apart.
Yeah.
Unintentionally.
I mean, everyone, you know, they are, you know, separated at this point, but I'm in the opinion, I think that they're probably still technically married.
Oh, yeah.
I doubt they ever got, like, an actual divorce or anything. They just kind of went and did their own things.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, yeah, no, Kylo's, you know, Ben is definitely the source of of the friction between Han and Leia.
Right. And I'm with you. I don't think that there was divorce proceedings. I think they've just gone their separate ways. It's just a great scene to see them. And one thing I want to just mention real quick before we wrap up, because I've always been very critical of some of the camera angles in Force Awakens and how un-Star Wars-y they are, right? Because we all know when George shot all six films, he did it in this kind of documentary style, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everything is kind of a little bit from a distance. You never have panning shots of characters. You just don't have those weird angles like modern cinema does. But when I was watching, and I actually just rewatched the whole movie in general last week for the first time in a while, I noticed that there is a lot of classic George Lucas shooting in this film, and it's particularly noticeable in these kind of more classical moments. And what I mean by that is here at the end of the film, when Han and Leia are like first seeing each other and then talking, like that wide angle shot of the two of them just standing looking at each other.
Yeah.
When Han comes out of the Falcon to invite Rey, you know, on the hero's journey in a sense, that's all shot in very classic Lucasian style. There's a lot of those like kind of classic Star Wars moments, and whenever those are happening, it's clearly Lucasian ways of filming. But what I actually kind of like about the different angle stuff is it's different. It's telling us something different about the story. So I'm going to give two quick examples of that. One,
okay,
when Kylo, you know, that really weird angled shot of Kylo as he walks in through the debris. To me, it kind of mirrors the frustration of Kylo's character, you know, and it's following him into this maelstrom. And Kylo knows Han is there. We can be pretty clear about that. I mean, if he can sense Han like miles away on Starkiller Base, he's going to be able to sense Han, you know, 1,000 yards away.
Right.
The other one too, though, is after Kylo takes off with Rey and Finn comes running back to say, like, he took her. Did you see that? He took her. The camera, again, does kind of this weird angle thing as it comes in on Han and Chewie. And to me, it's a reflection of Han's, like, disorientation. The shot itself is disoriented to kind of mirror Han's own feeling of disorientation.
Yeah.
So, again, it may not be that at all, but to me, it's like, okay, I kind of actually like that. Like, that does work a little bit.
It's a technique, I believe, that they in art called the disorienting diagonal. I think it's disorienting or something like that. But it's a diagonal, and it's either done with things on set or the camera angles or something like that. And it's supposed to just give things a slightly off-kilter look.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used often in like horror movies and things like that to really get you on edge and to, you know, just make things not seem right. But it's also used, you know, effectively in these types of situations too, where it's, you know, mirroring what's going on within a character or in a situation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a artistic, what's the word I'm looking for? State. It's an artistic thing that's been, you know, done for a long time. So, I think it works pretty well here.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's going to wrap up this Act 2 episode for Force Awakens. Woo. Yeah.
Again, so Act 2, long episode.
Oh, my God, they're so long. reminder to all of you that we will be doing next episode our poll response of what is your favorite piece of music off of the Rogue One soundtrack. So be sure to let us know about that.
Yes, because we're really excited about it and we really like it and we want to know what you want to say about it. So
yes.
And Carl, if they want to weigh in on our poll or anything else about The Force Awakens Act 2, where can they do that?
Over on Facebook, facebook.com/wampaslairpodcast. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/wampaslair. Send us an email at wampaslairpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, we could always use your support over on Patreon. Lots of bonus episodes to unlock if you're willing to pledge. Some great stuff coming up in the future via Patreon as well, which we'll cover soon. But if you could give us any support, head on over to patreon.com/wampaslairpodcast.
All right. Anything else?
That's going to wrap this one up.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of the Wampa's Lair podcast. This is episode number 218, The Force Awakens, Act 2. For Carl, I'm Jason, and we will see you next time here in the Wampa's Lair.